Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, Scottsdale officials change language in an effort to save a proposed ballot measure.
And from Rafi to Lerner and Rowe, we see ads for lawyers everywhere, but it wasn't always allowed.
But first, Vice President Kamala Harris is addressing the Democratic National Convention and the country tonight as she wraps up the four-day celebration in Chicago and attempts to define herself and her vision to the country in this truncated campaign. It's only been a month since her campaign even started, and in that time, trends in national polls have largely changed, showing Harris with the lead that Trump once held. That's also true among a growing and key demographic in American elections, Latino voters. But our first guest this morning found Harris has not yet reached the level of support among Latinos that Democrats have historically needed to win the White House. Russell Contreras is justice and race reporter for Axios, and he's on the line now to tell us more about it. Good morning, Russell.
Good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. So you reviewed exit polls going back like 50 years to find out when Democratic presidential candidates win, how much they win by with Latino voters, right? Like, so what did you find? Tell us, what's the threshold?
Yeah, going all the way back to Jimmy Carter in 1976, what we found is that when a Democratic presidential candidate gets below 65, 61%, they tend to lose. This is because this demographic in key states can push you over the edge. When you looked at Jimmy Carter, for example, he won around 76% of the Latino vote. Mm-hmm. And then when he ran in 1980, he won only about 55%. So a big drop in Latino support. And of course, Ronald Reagan won in 1980. When you look at, say, John Kerry in 2004, he got in the 50s, 50% of 53% of the Latino vote and lost to George Bush in a close race.
Right.
So when a Democratic presidential candidate gets under 65, it's usually bad news for them.
So where does Harris stand now?
Well, there's been a surge. Right now, when Biden was running, there was concern among Democrats that Latinos just weren't engaged. The Democrats were not given any kind of enthusiastic push in this community. And since Harris entered the race, we've seen a surge in interest. Biden was polling in the 40s. It was bad news. Now Harris has surged in the mid-50s. That's mm-hmm. great news for them. They think it's going in the right direction, but it's not reached that threshold they want. They need the magic number to be about 66% or higher. And increasingly, this voting bloc is getting stronger and stronger. It's growing. So in 1976, it was small, or 1976, it was tiny. Now it's huge and could be surpassing Black voters very soon.
Right. So talk a little bit more about that and how essential the Latino vote is to any candidate winning today. This is especially important in states like Arizona, but really nationwide.
That's right. We tend to look at the vote where it's significant in terms of population in Texas and California. Those have been historically safe red and blue states. New Mexico, too. But where this vote can really make a difference is in places like you mentioned, Arizona and Nevada and Georgia. There's a growing number of votes there. Latino voters are growing there, especially Mexican immigrants. Why is that important? Yes, it's small, but the election is going to be so close that that population has a key in swinging a state election. They're also important in Michigan. We tend to overlook the population in Michigan. And there's a growing population in the Midwest, even in states like Nebraska, that could be in play because of Tim Walz's addition to the ticket. These areas could really decide the Electoral College results. And as this population grows, their importance also grows, and they're going to be bringing up new issues. It's not just getting them out to vote, but it's also engaging them and telling the politicians, hey, look, you may be talking about climate change, enough with the EVs. I'm talking about clean water. That's my focus.
Interesting. So, right, I wanted to ask you about issues here because former President Donald Trump is at the border here in Arizona today. The GOP has seen the border and immigration as a weakness for Kamala Harris. How much does that matter to Latino voters? Like, is that their top issue?
You know, we did a recent Axios Vibes poll with Harris, and we found that immigration among Latinos it ranks like number 7 or 8. Hmm. Overall, they're more concerned about jobs, inflation. In fact, the top three issues that we polled them on: inflation, housing affordability, jobs and wages. Those are the top three. Border security is like number 8. Mm-hmm. And the pathway to citizenship was the last, only 5%. 45% or 47% were concerned about inflation. Only about 19% were about securing the border. So going the border, actually, Trump is not necessarily appealing to Latino voters. He's appealing to white voters in the Midwest, where border security is more of an issue to them. On the border, not so much, especially because migration has slowed to a crawl.
That's really interesting. Okay, talk a little bit before I let you go, Russell, about the changing nature of this demographic. It's also like a really diverse group culturally, geographically, as you've mentioned. It's long time been seen as a solid kind of Democratic voting bloc, but this is shifting, and their support for Democrats has kind of gone up and down historically, as you found in your analysis of the exit polls we talked about. What are we seeing today?
Yeah, and you know, the narrative always been is that Latinos are becoming more conservative, more Republican. We don't find that in our poll. What they've always been is very swingy. Yes, they side with Democrats more so than others, but they're not as loyal Democratic as, say, Black voters. They go up and down. What this demographic is, one thing is growing, and it's growing in pockets of the country that we've never seen Latino voters. Mm-hmm. It's becoming more Mexican-American. You have more third and fourth generation Mexican-Americans. It's also growing more diverse. So it's not as Mexican-American, it's becoming more Central American, it's becoming more Puerto Rican, and you're getting other different populations. When you get that mix, you don't have the traditional, say, the Cesar Chavez left-winging Chicano movement stuff. You're getting very diverse. I was just in Central California, for example, mm-hmm. going to the hot spots of the farm worker movement. They're not necessarily pro-union. They're very mixed. It's very nuanced. Even in the spots like that,
that's
it's
really
changing
interesting.
And we're going to see differences. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. We'll have to leave it there. Russell Contreras, justice and race reporter for Axios, joining us. Russell, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
The Scottsdale City Council has changed the wording of its description of a proposed ballot measure in an effort to keep it on November's ballot. At issue is Prop 490, which would enact a sales tax to pay for improvements at city parks and in the McDowell-Sonoran Preserve. The new tax would replace an existing one that's expiring and would be lower than the current rate. But the Goldwater Institute challenged the city's description of the new tax as a reduction, arguing residents would actually see a bigger reduction if the tax just expired altogether. Court of Appeals judges agreed and reversed a lower court ruling, ordering the city to remove the measure from the ballot. But yesterday, the city council made its wording change in an effort to allow voters to weigh in. With me to talk through all this is Sam Kamak of the Arizona Republic. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning.
So let's talk through what the existing tax is and what it actually pays for, the one that's expiring.
Sure. So it was approved by voters in 1995 and has a 30-year lifespan. So it's set to expire June of next year. And it was a 0.2% sales tax that funded the city's acquisition of land for the McDowell-Sonoran Preserve. And so since that's about to expire next year, the city proposed this new, it's a new tax, but they billed it as a replacement tax for the 1995 tax, as you mentioned in your intro, and it's slightly less. And it would fund slightly different things too. I mean, upkeep on the preserve, yes, but most of the money that would come out of this new tax, Prop 490, would go towards city parks.
So as you say, the new tax would be lower than the existing one, but Goldwater said, sure, except voters aren't being told that if they really want lower taxes, they should just let this thing expire and vote no.
Exactly. And that was their big issue with it. Because the city did bill it as a reduction. In some sense, it would be if it's a true replacement of the former one, because the overall tax rate for the city with all the sales taxes and everything combined would ultimately be lower because of the, you know, the new sales tax is slightly lower than the old one. Mm-hmm. But Goldwater's big issue was like, hey, we can't look at these two things as just one kind of tax combined, because the 95 tax is going to expire next June, regardless of what happens. So essentially what residents are voting on is, implementing a brand new tax on themselves, even though it's somewhat similar to the previous one. So it can't fairly be called a reduction. That was their argument.
Right. Well, so what did the Court of Appeals say about that? Because they, as I mentioned, they overturned a lower court rule, judge, which had said the measure can stay on the ballot. The Court of Appeals reversed that. What was their reasoning?
They basically just agreed with that argument that Goldwater laid out, and I just reiterated. But it's more, I guess there were two big pieces. One is that it just can't be fairly called a reduction for those reasons. And two, that the city did not do a good enough job of explaining what a no vote would mean in November. As you mentioned, that it would be a larger reduction in the overall tax rate if they voted no than if they decided to approve Prop 490.
Okay, so yesterday the Scottsdale City Council met and quickly changed the wording of this. What did they do, and does that do enough to get this measure back on the ballot?
Yeah, I mean, they basically just removed any mention of it being a replacement or a reduction. It was just they shifted the language to make it clear that it's a new tax, in something that was in line with what the court's ruling was. It's pretty, far more standard boilerplate language at this point.
Okay.
And as far as whether it does enough to get the measure back on the ballot, there's no reason to think that it won't be enough. But I guess that has yet to be seen, because they do have to send it in the Secretary of State's office. I'm not sure when it becomes official that the language changed. Assuming that there's no issue with the Secretary of State's, it'll probably be on the ballot if Goldwater doesn't sue again. And it seems like Goldwater's issue has been addressed. But it's been such a legal roller coaster, you never really know.
Right. Well, so this is all happening in the context of other elections in the city of Scottsdale. And I want to quickly ask you about the mayoral race. Has mm-hmm. this played an issue? Like, is this particular tax an issue in the mayor's race?
No, I know that the current incumbent mayor, David Ortega, who's running for his second term, is supportive of it. He's voted for it on the dais every time it's come up, whether it be, the decision to put it on the ballot, the name change yesterday or 2 days ago, excuse me. I don't know what his challenger, Lisa Borowski, thinks about it. I haven't heard her speak specifically to this issue.
Okay.
But I know that she is in this camp of particularly fiscally conservative candidates. And I know that her allies who are currently on the council have not been supportive of the measure when it was put on the ballot, or even yesterday when the name change happened.
All right, fair enough. That is Sam Kamak of the Arizona Republic. Sam, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, if you're watching TV, listening to the radio, or driving around Phoenix, it's nearly impossible to avoid ads for lawyers. But it wasn't always that way.
The law is a profession, not a business, and advertising was seen as undignified. Or in other words, if you're advertising, it's obvious that you're looking for business.
We'll hear about the Arizona case that led to the proliferation of attorney advertisements.
But first, our next guest this morning has been working to preserve indigenous languages for her entire career. But her exposure to it started long before her career did.
I was born into Hopi culture and the Hopi world for the first 6 years of my life, totally immersed in that world, that culture, that language. And then I went to school at age six in a local school on the reservation where I learned English. But those first 6 years were all about hearing and speaking the language, learning about the culture through the traditions, through the practices, everything that is Hopi.
Sheila Nicholas is a University of Arizona professor, where she's director of U of A's West Region Native American Language Resource Center. They recently got a big grant from the Department of Education to build this new resource center there, aimed at language revitalization efforts. It's one of four new centers doing similar work at other colleges, from the University of Hawaii to Little Priest Tribal College in Winnebago, Nebraska. Hopi, like a lot of indigenous languages, is an oral language. But Nicholas told me that goes far beyond just speaking it. The literacy part of the language, the reading and writing, was developed much later. And Nicholas credits that to her uncle.
So my client uncle is or was a research anthropologist at the University of Arizona and also a self-taught linguist. His interest in Hopi language, because he was a fluent speaker, he was very interested in thinking about Hopi language as a written form. And he spent a lot of his professional and academic life working on creating an orthography for the Hopi language. Mm-hmm. And before his passing, published a 30,000 word dictionary in the Hopi language. Yeah.
That's fascinating. So tell us, like, what did that mean to you? I mean, this came literally from your own family. And what does it do to the language and to the preservation of it when you have something like a dictionary, when you've taken this oral language and turned it into something that can be written?
Hopi still is primarily an oral language. So within the Hopi population, there are not that many who are what we would say able to read and write the language in the, you know, sort of Western form of alphabet reading and writing. There are just a handful. It is something that is very new. So I also want to clarify this idea of literacy, because Hopi and probably other tribal communities have literacy. It's more of an expression through symbols and of their semiotic perspectives and processes.
Yeah.
So everything that is represented and expressed of our experiences with the language and the place where we became a people, you see on clothing, ceremonial artifacts, some of our utilitarian objects, ceremonial objects, all those kinds of things.
It sounds like the language has always been very connected to the land itself, like the place, the physical place.
Yes. That's very true.
Is that a challenge in trying to preserve it today because so many people have moved off of the land?
It can be. Once you leave the reservation earlier, let's say at the time that I left the reservation back in the probably late 50s and 60s, it was a challenge, but 60 miles is not that far away and you could go back and you participate in all that is Hopi. But if you move farther away, yes, the diaspora has created a bigger challenge, because then you are trying to maintain that language and all of the way of thinking about a Hopi way of life immersed in an English environment. And the people that you might speak to or speak with are no longer there. So it definitely becomes a challenge to maintain that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So I read this quote from you that you said that you talk about your language as asleep and not extinct. Can you explain that?
Well, I think the idea of that is that the discourse of extinction or moribund, all of the or loss, all have come to us from the external, you know, perspectives of our languages, because we don't speak them or it's not heard anymore. We think they are lost, they're dead, that kind of thing. But if you take cases like the Wampanoag in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, that language was preserved through documentation in written form early. And one individual, through dreams that her ancestors, you know, presented to her with this calling, became a linguist and went back to those documents and brought them back to life and raised her own children in that language. So a community of people now are speaking that language. That means that, you know, it didn't die. It didn't go extinct. It just went to sleep. Mm-hmm. And so we are reawakening our languages because we believe, using the Hawaiian analogy, is that that's our life spirit, and it's our Maoli, it's within us. And what we have done over the years is we have sort of snuffed out the life by all these external kinds of experiences that took away the life spirit or the oxygen or the air. And so we just have to take away those experiences, rethink them, and give new life and oxygen and air to our languages, our life spirit.
That's a beautiful way of putting it. Let me ask you lastly about this new grant to fund this work for another 5 years here, kind of across the southwestern region. Talk a little bit about the goal with that. Like, this is sort of a continuation of work you've been doing for a very long time. Is the goal to preserve these languages, but in a way, like you're talking about, where it's something that can be spoken in everyday life, like to make it something that people really use?
Yes, that's the outcome. I think it's over the years, we have had to really spend a lot of time observing, rethinking, because we have been really, I guess, informed by current research in this field. But previously, what we did was we used the Western model that centers the word teaching, the discourse of teaching. And we never taught our languages before. We just used them.
Yeah.
And so now when you think about teaching, you're thinking of formal spaces, specific times, certain time allotted to it, reading and writing, materials have to be developed versus just using it, right? And so that's been the challenge. And I think over the years, we have been able to see, and we are totally informed, fortunately and gratefully, to communities have already started to use the spaces of school and created immersion schools.
Right.
Because they have instead taken their languages to be the medium of instruction for culturally based content in these schools. So they're bringing it all together in these formal spaces only because that's where time is allotted, funding is allotted, the work can be supported, you know, today because it has to be connected to funding. But, you know, what happens in those schools is hoping that because that language becomes a language of the school, then it will be transferred into the home and community. And in the immersion schools, that does happen to a large degree because the people who are involved in that community, those community schools, are actually the parents and grandparents, and it's been intergenerational.
Yeah.
So that's how they're building capacity, using the school system in order to bring it back into the community and family.
All right. Sheila Nicholas, Professor of Teaching, Learning, and Sociocultural Studies at the U of A, as well as Director of the U of A's West Region Native American Language Resource Center. Sheila, thank you so much for coming on and telling us about your work here and your own story.
Thank you.
The end of summer is finally in sight. While that may mean we finally start to see sub 100 temperatures here in the valley, it also means we're coming to the end of vacation season. And whether you're staring down a new semester of school or the busy season at your job, you may be feeling a little overwhelmed. But before you seek relief from the internet's cottage industry of productivity and stress reduction life hacks, ASU professor Ron Broglio would like to propose an alternative. As he recently suggested to the show's Sam Dingman, when you're tempted to do something drastic, consider the opposite solution.
To do nothing. Don't do any study work. Don't do email. Do something for yourself. Remind yourself what it means to be human, why you're doing any of these things. Just lay fallow. You know, we let the land lay fallow for a bit. And it's, while it looks like the land is not doing anything, it's actually being restorative. The nutrients are being restored. And so this is an invitation to do that on a micro scale.
Is this a practice you have put into place for yourself?
It is. I've come from a religious tradition. So both in the Catholic Church, where I was on a 30-day silent retreat, and in a Zen Buddhist context, where we would do like two-week meditative retreats. And those kind of really deep experiences, you come up against yourself and just kind of confronting ourselves and being alone and not being able to distract and learning to be bored again, which is actually a valuable skill.
And can you say at all what you feel like taking these fallow periods for yourself, whether it's time in a hammock or meditation or silent retreat, what you feel like the taking of that time has enabled?
One of the first things you notice, if you begin to notice things, you notice how you distract, how your mind wants to wander and grab at things and distract itself. And then eventually over a few days, and it takes days really to just calm down and just be alone with yourself and begin to be comfortable with it. And that means comfortable with things you don't like about yourself and things that you enjoy. And so it's a really kind of deep sitting with the moment.
This is a sort of radical proposition in the modern world. The idea that you would do something that has no concrete goal, really, that voluntarily subtracts the non-doer from the push to achieve or accumulate. And it is also kind of formless. It's such a threat to the algorithmically driven tuning that we all are sort of funneled into.
We live in a world that has an imperative for ordering and efficiency. And why do we do this? For greater ordering and efficiency. And it continues on and on. And so this seems like something that's incredibly inefficient, right? Just this pause. And what that does is it jams the gears of a technological age of ordering efficiency to remind us that's not all that it means to be human.
It also makes me think, I guess, about the fact that we live in a time when it seems like we have an infinite array of choices, and that, at least just to speak personally, often creates a sense of near paralysis for me, because it feels like I could be doing almost anything right now. And what if I choose the wrong thing to do? And so the idea of choosing actually to not choose, it makes me think about the fact that there was a time when there were not as many choices. So there's a bit of a time travel element to it.
Yeah, no, it's lovely. For me personally, it's part of embracing finitude. It's realizing that every choice we make means the death to other options. But then that choice is a commitment. And without making any choice, we never arrive anywhere, right? So each choice is a loss, but that loss allows other gains and other things to open up. And so that choice to do nothing is a chance to kind of realize that, to come up against some of our limitations and our finitude, that we can't do it all.
You know, you're also making me think, though, that it also encourages us to confront something that is very uncomfortable to think about, which is that, generally speaking, our lives are just the accumulation of choices that we make. So by choosing to do nothing for a little bit of time, it creates some space to reflect on the choices that we have made and what we've gotten from those choices. And if we don't like what they've added up to, we could make different choices.
And even when it's difficult to say, you know, I only get this opportunity once. You know, this moment, even the moment of pause, this only comes once in the universe, ever. And then the next moment only comes once. And so realizing that, we can stay with whatever we're working through.
So we hear these ideas sometimes in conversations about the kind of world of productivity hacking and, you know, should we have a 4-day work week, and what are the ways that we can optimize our ourselves as workers, like doing more in a smaller number of days or something like that. But the end goal a lot of times in this conversation is to get more out of our work life. And I am struck by the way you're talking about it because it does not seem contextually necessarily to be related to work.
Right, yeah. So being part of the Humanities Institute, we're really interested in the human aspect of this and the longer historical term cultural aspects of these pauses. So the Sabbath, if we think within the Jewish tradition, this is the chance to pause and to step away from our work life and to realize there's a larger world. But even in a non-theistic context, it's a world outside of just labor.
What kinds of reactions have you gotten from students, friends, people in your life to these ideas? And I ask that because I could imagine it really unnerving people.
Right. I mean, you know, so being at a university, when people found out about this, there was a sense of delight. There was a sense of kind of, wow, that's possible?
I mean, I completely understand why it hits people as sort of delightful and absurd and surprising. Even though if you stop and think about it, what is actually absurd and surprising is the ease with which we have handed over the ordering of our life. But that's become the norm. This deeply human impulse is what is now seen as absurd.
Yeah, it's a great resetting of norms. That's a great way of thinking about it, just to reset what constitutes the norm.
Well, Ron Broglio is the director of the Humanities Institute at ASU. Ron, thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. The word indoctrination has been coming up a lot recently, oftentimes referring to education. In some quarters, there's a lot of concern about what students are learning in schools, and in some cases, who's teaching them. My next guest writes about conspiracy theories and tackled both the history of this concept and the current debate about it. Colin Dickey's piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education is called The Specter of Indoctrination. He joins me to talk more about it. And Colin, one of the things you write about is that this is not a word that's been in use for a very long time.
Right. I found it really fascinating because it's such a key word right now, and it gets used so often in political conversations and conversations about education and higher education that it seemed a kind of bedrock idea about how we viewed education. But when I looked into it, I found that this is not always the case, that for the longest time, indoctrination did not have a particularly negative connotation. It was used by the military primarily to just describe the orientation of civilians into military life, of how they became acclimatized and accustomed to military procedures. And that's just what indoctrination meant. And it wasn't spun as a negative thing until the post-war era, really, until the 1940s and 50s.
Well, so what happened at that time that led people to start using it as maybe a more nefarious activity or something to be avoided and afraid of?
Right. So what happens, and it's really fascinating, is in the Korean War, we start to see American prisoners of war who are being recorded saying things that look like they might be in favor of communism. Maybe they are turning their back on American ideas and capitalism. And people start to get worried that the communists have developed some kind of brainwashing technique. And so we start to talk more and more about this idea of communist indoctrination, this idea that people can be subjected to a conditioning that will change their beliefs from something pro-American and pro-capitalism and in line with our values into something that seems very alien and foreign to us. And so this idea that communist indoctrination is happening, could be happening overseas with our soldiers who have been kidnapped, but may also be happening at home, really starts to take off. And sooner or later, indoctrination ceases to need that communist adjective before it. It's just sort of anytime anybody believes something we, you know, we broadly speaking disagree with, we start to wonder, oh, have they been indoctrinated somehow?
Hmm. Do you get the sense that for folks who are using that word now, especially as it relates to schools and education, do they believe that there is some kind of conditioning going on, like what, you know, was alleged to be have been happening during the Korean War, that there's some kind of strange program happening here that is, you know, sort of brainwashing students? Or is it something else that they're referring to, maybe just a presentation of information or perspectives with which they disagree?
I mean, it's really hard to know for sure what people actually believe, but I do think the rhetoric is pretty consistent that when people talk about indoctrination in the schools, what they mean is that children are, you know, and even college students who are adults, but students are emotionally and ideologically vulnerable, and they are being subjected to a belief system that they wouldn't otherwise adopt by teachers and professors who are using secret tactics, either pressure or, you know, something akin to brainwashing, into teaching children and college students to believe something they wouldn't otherwise believe.
What is the line between indoctrination and, I guess, believing that somebody can change their mind on things or have an open mind to consider perspectives that maybe they wouldn't otherwise consider?
You know, I think if you look at how the rhetoric is used, that line is, if I agree with it, it's not indoctrination. And if I don't agree with it, it is an indoctrination. So, you know, what I looked at in the piece that I wrote for the Chronicle was specifically looking at the college students who were engaged in protests regarding Israel's actions in Gaza, and how a lot of people online, a lot of commentators, were accusing these students of having been indoctrinated, despite the fact that this is a broadly held opinion by all sorts of Americans of all ages and of all education levels. So it really seems to be the case that people use the phrase indoctrination to describe a phenomenon when students believe things that they don't agree with.
For folks who are saying that, how do they sort of mesh that with the idea of learning new things and expanding your horizons and maybe taking on perspectives and agreeing with things that maybe you hadn't agreed with before?
I don't find it particularly ideologically consistent the way it gets deployed. I think that indoctrination has become a word that has such negative connotations that it gets used quite sloppily by people. And so there is a lot of hypocrisy, and I think that spans the ideological spectrum. You see it a lot with right-wing commentators who will talk about, on the one hand, we need to save our students from being indoctrinated with socialist values, and then simultaneously say we need to instill values of love of country and patriotism and capitalism. And it's very clear that instilling is sort of the same method as indoctrinating, but one of them is positive and one of them is negative. And of course, you see this on the left too, in a different set of values. And once again, it is a question of, if we agree with the lesson being taught, we are instilling good values. If we disagree, then we are indoctrinating dangerous ideas.
Hmm. One of the things that you write about, which I thought was really interesting, was this idea of, even if college professors wanted to indoctrinate their students, like, do they even have the power to do that? Is it even possible for them to do that? And the conclusion, it seems, that you drew is it's really not possible for a variety of reasons.
Right. I mean, this is the thing I find quite ludicrous about the whole argument, is this idea that college professors are indoctrinating young people with these dangerous ideas, where if you talk to anybody who's teaching college right now, particularly since the pandemic, particularly since, you know, there was a year or two of online instruction, professors will across the board tell you they can barely get students to show up to class. They can't get students to do the reading. And it's sort of unclear how they can exert this Svengali-like ideological pressure over students who are struggling to engage in sort of basic levels of functioning at the university, of showing up, passing classes, doing the reading, taking tests. These, we're operating in a very different landscape right now. And it's, I think students have had a hard time. Students have a hard time adjusting back to the life of college, and college professors are struggling to meet students where they're at. And I think the idea that college professors have this ability to do this nefarious kind of brainwashing is a laughable non-starter given the reality of what college is today.
Colin, thanks so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. This has been great.
Colin Dickey writes about conspiracy theories. His piece called The Specter of Indoctrination appeared in the Chronicle of Higher Education. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Here are some ads you've probably heard a whole lot. Call Rappy Rappy.
Rappy Rappy. I'm calling Rappy Rappy. Hi, I'm Mark Breyer.
And I'm Alexis Breyer. We're the husband and wife law team.
To get the compensation you deserve, call Goldberg and Osborne. Learner and rope is the way to go.
Call 977-1900. That's right. From Rafi to Lerner and Rowe's incredibly catchy jingle, ads for lawyers seem to be everywhere. Buses, billboards, on your TV, on your radio. If you get in a car accident or you get divorced, you know who to call. And that's the idea. But I found out recently it wasn't always like this. In fact, for a very long time, lawyers weren't allowed to advertise. And it was an Arizona case that changed that. I spoke more about it with clinical law professor Anne Ching with ASU Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. She's also former ethics counsel for the State Bar of Arizona.
That's correct. Lawyer advertising was actually pretty much strictly prohibited for decades, up until the late 1970s. So lawyers perhaps could have their name and phone number in a phone directory. That was really about it. So anything that we think of nowadays as advertising on television, radio, billboards, none of that was allowed.
That's so interesting. So what was the thinking behind that? Like, why was the default, no, you cannot advertise?
There were a few different justifications for the prohibition. One really broad justification was that the law is a profession, not a business, and advertising was seen as undignified. Or in other words, if you're advertising, it's obvious that you're looking for business, that you're trying to make money.
Right.
And the idea was, because lawyers are professionals, it's undignified, and lawyers should be seen as only wanting to practice the law and serve the public, and we're not going to talk about the fact that lawyers also need to make money to sustain themselves.
That's obviously a very different conversation today, but we'll get to that. Mm-hmm. Talk about when this changed. This was actually an Arizona case that spurred this change, right?
That's correct. So the case started around 1976 when there were two recent ASU law grads, John Bates and Van Osteen. And they placed an ad in the Arizona Republic. It was a very straightforward ad advertising their firm. They called it a legal clinic, listing some different services that they provided, listing the fees that each service would cost the client, designating these as reasonable fees in the advertisement itself. And the State Bar of Arizona disciplined those two lawyers for running that ad because at that time, Arizona still had the rule that no advertising was allowed. So they actually had a six-month suspension imposed, which is a pretty serious sanction.
Yeah, but they fought back.
They did. They ended up taking their case eventually all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And in a 5-4 decision, the court actually sided with the two lawyers, and they held that Arizona's advertising ban violated the First Amendment.
So it's a First Amendment issue. So how quickly did this change things? Like, did you immediately start to see, you know, advertisements pop up all over the place for lawyers?
You know, it's hard to say how quickly it happened because this was a while ago. The decision came out in 1977. I can tell you, as someone who grew up here in Arizona and was a little kid in the early 80s, by the time I can remember, maybe around 1980, 81, there were a lot of ads on TV and on the radio. And I'm not going to try to sing any of the jingles
there
I remember
always a jingle,
from my
yeah.
childhood, but there were some famous ones. And if you talk to anyone who's been around Arizona for 40 or 50 years, they would probably remember. So it became pretty widespread because, you know, once the court held that this type of commercial speech couldn't be strictly prohibited, the rule essentially had to go away. Although states were still allowed to regulate lawyer advertising.
Ah.
So states were still allowed to have rules that prohibited, for example, false or misleading advertising.
Okay. I wonder why it happens most in certain areas of law. Like, it seems like I see a lot of personal injury lawyer ads, maybe some divorce lawyer ads are pretty common to see that kind of thing. Is it because that's just like the kind of thing you want people to think of right away if they get in a car crash or need a divorce attorney?
I do think that's a part of it. Name recognition, brand recognition is a big part of any advertising, including for lawyers. And these are also high volume areas of practice. So areas of practice where it's important to get a lot of clients and to sustain a large client base. Mm. So there's a good chance that many people will have a car accident at some point in their lives or have a domestic relations issue, a family law issue. Whereas other types of legal practice depend more on word of mouth or client referrals, perhaps corporate law, real estate law, you might not see as much because you're trying to target your potential clients where they are. Mm-hmm. So you're targeting people who might get into car accidents while they're on the road or while they're waiting for the bus.
Which is why they're on the side of a bus.
Exactly.
So is this a good thing? Like, are there ethical debates around this now in terms of, you know, maybe it's a good thing because it serves the public to have these resources readily available to them? Or are there people in the legal world who think that this is predatory?
I do believe that there is still some tension in the rules and their application. And what it does is it demonstrates that there still is, even nowadays, a tension between thinking of the law as a business or as a profession. Mm. And another part of it, too, is thinking about the point of these rules. Is it to protect the public, to protect consumers or potential clients, or is it to protect lawyers and their business interests by placing some guardrails on advertising?
Mm.
Whether there is any debate about it today, I think the ones who care about it the most are probably lawyers. There probably are still lawyers who feel that it makes the legal profession seem a little bit undignified, seem more like a money grab. But nowadays, most lawyers do understand that there's a benefit. There's a benefit to allowing the public to know about legal services that are available to them, being able to make informed choices by knowing who the different lawyers and firms are in town. And something that's changed since the 1970s is that consumers have a lot more information accessible to them.
Right.
Consumers can more readily look online at things like reviews mm-hmm. of different firms and lawyers and gather information that way. And so consumers are considered to be a bit more sophisticated than they were in the past. And in fact, that was reflected recently when the Arizona Supreme Court actually changed the advertising rules in 2020.
What was the change?
The change was to really streamline the advertising rules and to get rid of many of the prohibitions other than the really broad prohibition that advertising cannot be false or misleading. So, for example, there used to be a rule that if you sent a direct mailing to a potential client or a group of potential clients, it had to be marked advertising material.
Right.
There's even a rule about the size of the font of the words and the color and all of that.
Reminds me of campaign ads, right?
Exactly. It was regulated in that manner because it was considered to be, again, a public protection measure. But as time had gone by, people who were, you know, examining these rules and then the court agreed that these types of prohibitions or these types of protections really weren't needed as much for the reasons that I just stated, because consumers are considered to be more sophisticated nowadays, more able to discern between mail that needs to be responded to versus a direct mailing advertisement, typical junk mail sort of letter.
That makes sense. All right, we'll leave it there for now. Ann Ching, clinical professor of law at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at ASU, joining us. Ann, thank you so much. I really appreciate this history.
Thank you, Lauren.
All right, well, those jingles will be stuck in my head for the rest of the day. Thanks, Lauren. Appreciate
that.
You
are welcome. Yeah.
On that happy note, that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.